When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast on how to be wrong. I'm John Traphagen, your host, and with me today is Stephen Dick, an astronomer, author, and historian of science, perhaps most noted for his work in the field of astrobiology. Steve served as the chief historian at NASA from 2003 to 2009 and the Bloomberg NASA Library of Congress Chair in Astrobiology from 2013 to 2014. Before that, he was an astronomer and historian of science at the United States Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. from 1979 to 2003, which, as you think about it, is really an interesting combination. I don't know how many astronomer historians there are out there. Steve is the author of numerous books and articles, a very prolific author, including his recent work, Space, Time, and Aliens, Collected Works on Cosmos and Culture, which was published by Springer in 2020. Steve, many thanks for joining me today on How to Be Wrong.
Thanks, John. I'm glad to be here.
Great. I think we'll have a fun conversation. I'm looking really forward to it. You've had an intriguing intellectual path. I looked over some of your background, and of course, we've talked about different things over the years at conferences. Beginning in graduate school, you developed an interest in the extraterrestrial life debate, which, as you know, was something of a taboo subject at one time in academia. In fact, that's, I think, one of the more interesting things that's happened in the last 30 years is that increasingly, people aren't giggling anymore when you talk about you have an interest in the possibility of extraterrestrial life. And so I wonder if you could, you know, tell our audience a bit about how you got from being a subversive graduate student to the chief historian at NASA.
Sure. It's a kind of a fun story. Let me start with by explaining the subversive graduate student part. I was at Indiana University as an undergraduate in astrophysics. And I always wondered, how we developed the ideas that we have now. And luckily, not too far away, just a few blocks away on the IU campus, was the Department of History and Philosophy of Science, one of the very few departments like that in the country. So I decided in graduate school to go into History and Philosophy of Science. And I was casting around for a subject to do as a dissertation. And as an undergraduate, we had read, this is the late 60s, we had read Shklovsky and Sagan's book on intelligent life in the universe, which became, for the next generation or so, the sort of the Bible of the whole search for extraterrestrial life discipline. So in searching around for a subject to write a historical dissertation on, I came up with the idea of, what's the whole history, especially the deep history of this whole debate? So I proposed to do that as a dissertation subject and was immediately told that, well, there are two problems with that in a history of science department. First of all, it's not science. And secondly, it has no history worth writing about. So what I did was decided to switch advisors and go down the hall to a professor who was actually a medievalist and who knew that there was a medieval, what they call the plurality of worlds tradition. In fact, it goes back to the ancient Greeks, Aristotle, and all of that. And so he was happy to take me on, and I did that dissertation on the history of the debate from going back from the ancient Greeks and only got as far as the middle of the 18th century after 4 years. So I ended there, but it turns out to have a fascinating history. And I think it was the first dissertation in that department to be published. So I had no regrets, and I always use this story to tell graduate students never to listen to your advisor, especially if you think you have a good idea.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I honestly can't tell you how many times I've heard a version of this story. I started with Advisor X, and either Advisor X just couldn't figure out what I was doing, or Advisor X was an asshole, which often happens too. And then I moved on to something else, and something else can be new advisor or completely different graduate school, which is what I wound up doing. I left my PhD and then took a few years off and then went back. My son actually did the same thing. It's just that story is so common in graduate school. And it's, I think it's really an example of how we often get tripped up in the process of trying to do something we want to do, and we have to go back and regroup.
That's right. And as I say, I have no regrets, because it turns out that extraterrestrial life debate, you know, as I say, only got to the middle of the 18th century. There are just so many questions that it raises in all kinds of different disciplines when you get into the more modern history, you know, whether it's philosophy or science or theology. And so all through my career, even though I wasn't doing astrobiology the full time, I always had that in the background and would go to the meetings and so on. And so that's a story of perseverance. So how I got to NASA was not by a straight line, because it was difficult back in those days in the 70s to get jobs. And the first job I had was actually at a publisher who was publishing a new encyclopedia, and I worked as a science editor. And then there was a job that I worked with a mad scientist out in Princeton, New Jersey, who had his own fusion energy scheme. He was actually a student of a Nobel Prize winner, who's a well-known physicist. And he had, I wasn't working on fusion energy. He had as a side project a journal they called Adventures in Experimental Physics, where you would talk to people who had made great discoveries and find out their stories. And so we did that for a while, until that company went bankrupt. And then I ended up at the Naval Observatory, as you mentioned, in Washington, D.C. So went from New Jersey to Washington, and was actually hired there as an astronomer based on my bachelor's degree. So you'll see throughout my career, I oscillated back and forth between astronomy and history. And the thing about the Naval Observatory is, you know, I did some good astronomy there, but also it is the oldest continuously operating scientific institution in the country, going back to 1830. And so it was also an opportunity to write the history of that institution, because it's the National Observatory for the United States, the original National Observatory, just like Greenwich Observatory and Paris Observatory. So I was able, while I was there doing astronomy, to walk down the hall to one of the best astronomy libraries in the country and write the history of the Naval Observatory.
So did you do that like in your spare time?
Pretty much. You have your duties there, and I did most of my writing, you know, take the books home from the library, and did most of my writing at home. And at the same time, I was still having my interest in astrobiology. So I'd be going to various astrobiology meetings, you know, American Astronomical Society and some of the other meetings that were held on astrobiology. And that put me in good stead when a position opened at NASA for the NASA Chief Historian in 2003, because I had been working on various things with the NASA Astrobiology program. And so I was hired as the NASA Chief Historian in 2003.
So I'm just curious, you know, by 2003, we know there are lots of exoplanets. Do you think they would have hired you with that interest, say, in 1983 for that job?
Good question. Well, in 1983, I was still in my early years at the Naval Observatory, so I didn't have much of a track record. But I see what you mean. It's just very difficult to say. As you say, by 2003, you know, there were probably a few dozen exoplanets known by then, the first one being discovered in 1995, at least around a sun-like star. And of course, now we know there are thousands, and in fact, they're around planets around virtually every star. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's just, it occurred to me that, you know, this is one of the things that's changed. And from when you were in graduate school, when someone would say, well, there's nothing to talk about there, which of course was ridiculous when that was said in graduate school, because as you noted, people have been thinking about this for a long time. But by the 90s, when we started, you know, by 95, when we realized we had evidence that we weren't the only, I mean, everyone kind of knew, but we had evidence that we weren't the only place with planets. That kind of opened the door to taking astrobiology very seriously as a kind of core thing that NASA does, and rather than this kind of sort of thing out on the edge. And of course, you know, the with SETI, you know, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, gets cut by NASA in what, the early 90s, I think,
and that sort of 93 thing. Actually, yes, yeah, we can talk more about that too, but you're right, the exoplanets, NASA was very skeptical about exoplanets. Even NASA did not fund the early exoplanet discoveries, and only after some of those were discovered did NASA really jump in a big way, especially with the Kepler spacecraft, of course, which has discovered most of those planets.
Yeah, I think that's, it's the kind of a theme that you see here is the sort of the institutional resistance to chance taking, to asking questions that push a little bit beyond the edge of things, and institutions, whether universities or NASA or whatever, can make it really difficult to do that, and basically turn what is a reasonable question into one that's sort of perceived as a mistake, as something that you shouldn't be asking about. And, you know, clearly you hit that in graduate school.
That's right. And I was impressed by how much individuals matter also within institutions, because when you talk about the history of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you know, there were two or three people within NASA who were interested in that and pushed it to the highest levels. And that's why there was a NASA SETI program. And we can talk more about that, but there was not, in the end, there was not a big enough constituency across the country for that to survive, because when it came to votes in Congress for funding for that particular program, you know, not a lot of senators would support it, even if they were interested in it, because it didn't do anything for their constituents in that their particular state, except for California, where the SETI program was headquartered. And even then, it was pretty small amount of funding.
Yeah, we can never really ignore the fact that science is embedded in both history and politics. And, you know, what gets done for science is not just, gee, what scientists find interesting.
For sure.
You know, for one thing, you got to pay for it. And that often means government funding. And so that can be, you know, certainly fickle at best. Let me turn to a question I often ask guests about. Is something that went wrong in your life? I mean, in a way, we kind of touched on that in graduate school a little bit, but I guess in the end, that really went right. But can you talk about something either professionally or personally that just went wrong, and then how you responded to that error? You know, an example of something maybe that significantly changed your outlook on things?
Well, I'd have to say the first thing that went wrong was that I couldn't get a job in academia, which of course is what every graduate student wants to do, become a professor. Jobs were very hard to come by then. And as I say, I'd been by that time in either undergraduate or graduate school at Indiana University for 9 years. So I was determined not to stay another year. So I began applying for jobs, including going into the Air Force, which had a space and missile systems organization at that time, and was actually accepted into the Air Force when I got a call. I was almost ready to go when I got a call from this mad scientist in the Princeton area to come out and do that. So that was one of those real forks in the road, because if it hadn't been for that, I'd probably have had a career in the Air Force, which would have been very different. And I'm always impressed by these forks in the road, which affect the rest of your life. So, but I think again, the story there is one of perseverance, because as I say, I worked as a science editor for this encyclopedia. And then when I came to the Naval Observatory, was able to make use both of the astronomy and the history of science backgrounds that I had. So I think how I responded and how, you know, a good way to respond is to make the best with of the situation that you have, and always keeping some goal in mind. But, I was able at the Naval Observatory for the 20 some years that I was there to not only do astronomy, but also to write the history of the observatory and to participate in these various astrobiology meetings, and also had a chance to live in New Zealand for 3 years, where we had a Southern Hemisphere station on a mountaintop. So that was, quite an experience too.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I see in what you've managed to do, and I think this is really important, really for I think graduate schools in general to understand, is that you figured out how to take what you had done in graduate school and put the pieces together. So, the different interests, the interest in history of science, along with the background in actually doing science. And, unfortunately, the reality is that a lot of people who come out of graduate school aren't going to get the academic job that they want. And that really means creativity. It means you got to figure out some creative ways to put the pieces together. And the fact of the matter is, getting the academic job is often just a matter of luck. I came out at just the right time, given what I was doing, so that there were a variety of options available to me. And the study of Japan was really hot in the 90s because of the Japanese economy had been so big in the 80s. So there were jobs. And then all of a sudden, they all dried up because all of a sudden, China became the second largest economy over Japan. And, things being the way they are, everyone went, oh, right, Japan doesn't. I mean, I literally had someone ask me once, well, why should you spend time studying Japan? And I said, well, it is the third largest economy in the world. And he said, oh, really? I didn't know that. And that was an academic dean who said that to me at one point. And you'd think they'd know better. But, it's difficult coming out of graduate school. And so much of it is the timing right?
Yeah, and luck. I did apply for academic jobs and several times came in second, at pretty high ranking places. But coming in second is about the same as coming in 10th. And the end effect is that you don't have a job. So again, you have to be creative, as you say.
So you got to NASA just after the Columbia disaster. And I'd like to talk a bit about that. NASA is this organization which, we have this image of, from movies like Apollo 13, where, failure is not an option. And of course, they are an organization where they have to figure out how to deal with error because things don't always go right. And it's an environment where the stakes are really high. And that is both in terms of life and in terms of politics. And I wonder if you could, tell us a bit about how getting things right and wrong is dealt with at NASA and how perhaps maybe even a little bit more about how the culture of NASA shapes that.
Well, the things that immediately come to mind are the Apollo accident, which happened actually on the ground. We never had an Apollo death in outer space, although Apollo 13 came close. But also the two shuttle accidents, the Challenger in 1986 and the Columbia in 2003. And as you say, I came to NASA in November of 2003, just a few months after the Columbia accident. So the institution was just obsessed with what they call return to flight and how to avoid that kind of accident again. It's very difficult because, of course, the first thing that happens when you have an accident such as Challenger, and you recall that's the one where they were launching, I think it was January the 31st of 1986. It was extremely cold, below freezing. There was ice hanging all over the rocket. And when they took off, at 78 seconds, the vehicle blew up as it was, as it was taking off. And it was because what they call the O-rings, the seals between you know, on the solid rockets had frozen and weren't able to seal properly. And so gases escaped, and the end result was the whole thing blew up. And of course, the first thing that that NASA does is, you know, shut down the program and try and decide what the cause was. It was pretty clear in this case what the cause was. But the bottom line is that that was what you call schedule pressure, because I think it was that very night that Reagan was supposed to give his State of the Union address and was going to say how great the NASA manned spacecraft program was. And you know, there are there's always a lot of pressures to launch. I mean, you see that recently with the Artemis. You know, they really wanted to go that first time last week, but they had a hydrogen leak, and hydrogen is very flammable. And so they tried again, and they had the same problem. And now it's probably going to be mid-October before they try again. And so my friend said to me, "That's kind of embarrassing, isn't it?" I said, "It's embarrassing, but it's not as embarrassing as if the thing had blown up." So one of the huge themes at NASA is risk, risk and exploration. You know, we want to explore, but there are inevitable risks involved. I like to say, risk is the inevitable companion to exploration. And it's always a difficult call on things like launches. The Columbia disaster was similar in the sense that they had some forewarnings. The Columbia disaster, you recall, in 2003 happened not on launch, but on return. But there were things that happened on launch that kind of foreshadowed what happened. This was not a cold problem so much as a problem of foam falling off of what's called the external tank and hitting the shuttle wing, the left side of the wing, and putting some small holes in it. It was unclear from the video exactly how big the holes were, and this had happened before and had never caused the loss of the shuttle. And so they studied it and in the end decided that, it probably was not any more of a problem than it had been before. And so they would let them land. And if they hadn't let them land, you know, they could have stayed up maybe for another month and try and figure out, you know, go out and look at the wing and figure out some workaround, but there were really wasn't much that they could have done. So the end there was to take the risk, and of course the whole shuttle disintegrated as it came through the atmosphere coming across Texas there, and other southern states. And so you always have these evaluations of risk. And when I got to NASA, they were just convening a conference on risk and exploration, you know, with lots of experts. And of course, in the wake of that disaster, they had what was called the Columbia Accident Investigation Board, and all kinds of recommendations were put forth. One of the recommendations or one of the findings was that they hadn't learned all the lessons from the previous Challenger launch either in terms of schedule pressure and things like that. So that leads me to the, if you want to hear about the Hubble incident. So there were supposed, you know, Hubble is designed so that it can be repaired, which is a good thing, because when it first went up in 1990, it was blurry images because they had messed up on the testing of the mirrors. And so they did go up with a first servicing mission and fix all that. So there had been four servicing missions by the time of 2003, by the time of the Columbia accident. They're about every 2 or 3 years. And there was another one, servicing mission 5, which was supposed to be the final one, that was supposed to have been done, you know, in 2005 or 6, something like that. But with the Columbia accident, that put all of that on hold. And Sean O'Keefe was the administrator at that time. He was a manager, not an engineer like some NASA administrators had been. And he looked at all of the CABE recommendations and decided that 5th servicing mission could not be done. He canceled it, said it was just too risky. The shuttle could go up to the International Space Station, but it could not go up to Hubble, which was in a different kind of an orbit and much more, or considerably more risky, different inclination, higher orbit. The Columbia Accident Investigation Board had said that you have to have all these contingency plans if you're going to do that. And O'Keefe, the administrator, decided that it just wouldn't work. So what happened was that, of course, there was a huge uproar over that because that the 2007 or so, the Hubble Space Telescope would be dead if they didn't replace the batteries, the gyroscopes, and all these things they do when they go up for a servicing mission. So what happened was that O'Keefe eventually left NASA, and a new NASA administrator came in, Mike Griffin, who evaluated the risk and determined that we're going to go do it. And so they did. The last servicing mission, which I was there for the launch down at Cape Kennedy, was in May of 2009. And John Grunsfeld, the astronaut who had done most of the servicing missions, was on that mission, 13-day mission, achieved all of its goals. And the Hubble is still going today, of course. And if that call hadn't been made, if that hadn't been done, you know, all this time we would not have had a space telescope up there, at least not the kind that Hubble is. So that just goes to show you that was a great risk that Griffin took. And of course, things might have turned out otherwise. You know, he's a great hero after that to the Hubble people. But if things had gone wrong and astronauts had been killed, then he wouldn't have been a great hero. So there are always these calls that have to be made in terms of how much risk to be taken. And it's often said that NASA is risk averse. They're accused of being risk averse. So it really is a fine balance between safety and risk.
So it's interesting that NASA has a chief historian, and I'm curious why is that? Why is NASA interested in history? Is it so that it can go back and look at its mistakes, or you know, what motivates a large scientific organization like this to have an arm basically devoted to history?
Right. Well, NASA knew from the beginning that it was going to be doing historic things. Now, that doesn't mean they would automatically appoint a historian and have a history office, but there were people from the outside who pushed this point to the extent, to the high-level management, to the extent that they did establish a history office. And so NASA has had a history office virtually from the beginning of NASA in 1958. And there have been six NASA chief historians since then, including myself. And for a variety of reasons. One of them is to help learn lessons. In fact, that whole Hubble incident that I was just telling you about, the administrator O'Keefe, who made that decision, gave me the assignment of writing up and documenting exactly how he made that decision. And that meant interviewing everybody involved, from him, from the administrator to everybody on down, John Grunsfeld and the space science people and the engineers. And so I did that and wrote that up. And that's actually published in the Space, Time, and Aliens book. NASA does want to learn from its past experiences. That's one of the aspects of having a NASA history office. But there are many, many other reasons. The public is interested in history, and the NASA history office includes a huge archive. Some of the archives are in the National Archives, but the NASA history office at headquarters in Washington, D.C. has an archive, and some of the 10 NASA centers, like Johnson Space Center, also have their own archives and their own history programs, which are all tied together, through the NASA chief historian. And so archives is a big part of it, and answering queries, not only from the general public, but from the media. And that archives also services, many scholars who come to do research on NASA history. So you have, the kind of studies that O'Keefe commissioned, you have archives, you also have conferences. The NASA History Office does all kinds of conferences. So, for example, on the 50th anniversary of NASA, we did one. On the 50th anniversary of the space age, we did one. We did one on critical issues in the history of space flight, which, again, I think had many lessons that were useful to NASA. Another aspect of it is the book program. We commission lots of histories on various programs and aspects of NASA history. And we actually pay, professional historians to do this work over a period of 2 or 3 years on any particular project. So there's always a lot going on in the NASA History Office. So when I left, I think I had, I left in 2009, I had about 30 or 40 book projects going, some of which are still in the works. But one thing that I pushed while I was there was not only the nuts and bolts history. NASA had published a lot of books on, the F5 engines on the Saturn V or something like that. I pushed things like the societal impact of spaceflight. We did several volumes on that. And also the role of exploration in society and NASA's role in that. So it's a very broad portfolio that the NASA History Office has. And it's not always easy, I have to say, because, of course, NASA wants to hear, likes to hear good things, And they have a huge public affairs office. And sometimes they tend to confuse history with public affairs. And, of course, historians want to write objective history. And there's sometimes some pushback against that, despite the desire to have lessons learned. And so it's always a struggle sometimes to write objective history. But that's the foundation for the history program has been from the beginning and still is, even though it's a struggle sometimes.
Yeah, one of the things that I've thought about is that, as a historian of science and working in the context of a place that does science and engineering, it's almost like living inside Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He very clearly notes that there's this, of course, intersection of the fact that you have humans doing science. So you've got egos that are in the process of doing science. And, that shapes how things play out in the scientific community. But it's also interesting, as you were talking, it strikes me that, and this is something I think that many in the sort of science denial world seem to fail to understand, that science also tends to have built-in reflexivity in which it thinks about what it's doing. And there's this constant process of critique, even if people are resistant to that at times, because, of course, being critiqued is not fun. But there is this kind of natural structure there that keeps going back and asks, is this the right way to look at things, or did we get this wrong? And I'm wondering, how maybe that process has changed. Have you seen intensification of the role that egos play, or maybe less of that, since you started getting involved in this?
Right. Well, of course, Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, is famous for talking about paradigms versus normal science. In other words, most of science is normal science. You're plugging along, getting data, and then you have a big revolution, scientific revolution. In both of my jobs in the federal government, I've seen that, both sides of it, because the Naval Observatory, is a very practical organization. It's funded by the Navy, and not to do esoteric things, but for practical purposes. So the Naval Observatory, we do observations of star positions for navigation, and we do the nautical almanac for navigation. We do time signals down to they keep the time to down a billionth of a second per day, something like that. And the Naval Observatory is the sole source of time for the GPS satellites. So every time you're using GPS, in your car or wherever, that goes back to the time kept to a few billionths of a second at the Naval Observatory. But that all is sort of in the area of normal science. You're sort of plugging away, getting the data, making sure the GPS has its proper signal and all of that, which is quite different from what NASA does, which is more or can be revolutionary with the the many different satellites that they have, some of which make discoveries that are more or less earth-shaking. Even the Hubble, some of the observations of the age of the universe and the expansion rate of the universe, those approach more revolutionary science. So those are two quite different kinds of science, but I think you need both. And as for the egos in science, this reminds me of the whole movement of postmodernism, which means many things to many people. But one of the things it means to some people is that science is no different from theology or philosophy or, other areas of thought, which gets to your point that I think science is somewhat different because it's grounded in nature. And I've always thought that postmodernism is obvious on the one hand in that respect and absurd on the other hand. It's obvious in the fact that, as I found out being a part of scientific institutions, scientists are very human, make mistakes all the time, and egos are involved. But they do have, in the end, this grounding in nature, which is different from, philosophy or theology, where you can argue one side or the other, and nobody's really right because there's no real grounding in it. And as for that, how much that has changed over the years, I think science, is really under attack these days, and that's because some people don't understand, what science is all about. There are lots of mistakes, even in the area of health with Dr. Fauci and all that. They're doing the best they can with what they know. And sometimes they make mistakes, but then you always go back and correct as soon as you know more. And that's what science is all about. It's not that they're always right, but they're looking for what the right answer is.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the profound problems we're facing is that people don't really understand how science works, that it's really not a process of finding the truth. It's a process of falsifying the things that we think we know at a given point in time. But it's always changing because we're always learning more things. And as you learn more things, you realize what you thought you knew is sometimes just wrong, but sometimes it's also limited. You realize it isn't as extensive as you thought. And I don't think the general public in the United States understands that very well.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that's why we have some of the big problems that we have today.
Yeah. Which kind of brings me to a question that has been one of the themes of this podcast series. And we've been very focused on the idea of trying to understand the idea of what I've been calling intellectual humility. And I'm curious if you could offer some thoughts about this. How would you define intellectual humility as both a historian and as a scientist? And how do you think it plays out in NASA? Are there aspects in which there's a lack of intellectual humility that influences things at NASA or elsewhere, maybe more broadly in the astrobiology community? What happens? How does that concept play a role, do you think?
Yeah, good question. Well, I would say in terms of defining humility, it's, the fact that we may not know as much as we think we know. If you start with astrobiology, that's very obvious because we're looking for, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, looking for aliens. And the first thing you do, of course, or the first thing you think is that, well, they must be just like us. So let's figure out, how to find them. Of course, our concepts of intelligence and technology and communication may be totally alien to aliens. The ways we are looking for aliens may not be working at all. You can understand why SETI people are doing what they're doing in terms of they started out with radio telescopes. They start out with what they know how to do. But then you could ask the question, you know, if you think in a more or a less anthropocentric way, what you know, what are the other possibilities? One of the ones I've written about is maybe the aliens aren't biologicals at all. Maybe they're post-biological. Maybe they're artificial intelligence. What does that do to your search for extraterrestrial intelligence? Well, nobody's thought about that very much because we're, you know, thinking that they're going to be more like us. And the same thing with technology. We don't know if they have radio telescopes or communication, how they might communicate and if we can even communicate with them. And it's the same thing. So that's at the study level. At the lower level of finding microbes, you see the same thing, though. You have to make assumptions about what you're looking for, like the Viking landers on Mars or the Curiosity or whatever the current ones are that are up there, that they, you know, what experiments are you going to do to look for life based on what we now know about life. But life up there may not be what we think it is. So you really do need to have some intellectual humility, but it has to also be balanced with practicalities of being able to build an experiment that you know, that could work if life is like us.
Yeah, I've always thought with SETI that there's this kind of difficult, in some ways, unfortunate contradiction. On the one hand, the assumptions that we start with could just be utterly wrong because we only have one data point, Earth. On the other hand, we only have one data point, so what other assumptions can we make? It's kind of a catch-22 in terms of we do have to be willing to, I think, shed our assumptions, but then how do we go about looking for this possibility of intelligence or even just, you know, microbial life somewhere else? Because we haven't found anything else, and so we're kind of stuck.
Yeah, I tried to address this in one of my books, recent books, on astrobiology, a discovery and societal impact, where I have a chapter on how can you try and be less anthropocentric? How can you get out of your head? And of course, the problem is you can't get out of your head. You can you can try and think of alternatives, but you can't totally get out of your head. And this, you know, goes into a lot of philosophy too. Like Immanuel Kant said that the universe is what it is because of our brain structure, and it may not be like that at all. So it's a problem, and all we can try and do is work around it in all these different areas, but you can't entirely work around it. So we have to keep doing, I think, what we're doing. But recently, you know, there's been a lot of talk about technosignatures, which is much broader than the radio search. And part of this has been brought about by this interstellar asteroid that came through the solar system a few years ago. I think it's actually just this year sort of departing the outer solar system, the asteroid dubbed Oumuamua, which had some strange motions to the extent that this Abby Loeb, who was the chair of the astronomy department at Harvard, so, you know, no slouch, wrote an entire book arguing how this could have been an artifact from an extraterrestrial civilization. And that's given rise to you know, the broader area of technosignatures and how you might search for artifacts, you know, throughout the solar system, or bigger artifacts, you know, around stars like Dyson spheres, these things that, you know, could capture the heat, infrared radiation from a star. And even to the extent that Abby Loeb now has this thing called Project Galileo. I mean, the ultimate artifact would be a UFO, right? Or what they call UAPs these days, unidentified aerial phenomena. So Loeb has gathered a group of people who are systematically trying to scientifically look at the evidence for UFOs. And of course, this has raised a lot of eyebrows because the UFO debate has a long history of not having reputable people in, but it also has a long history of science not taking it seriously. Yeah. And my take on that has always been, you know, 97% of all sightings can be explained one way or another. But what about those other 3%? You know, maybe that is something unusual going on. It could be some physical phenomenon we don't understand. But to jump to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that's another level. And you'd have to have, as Sagan always said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And, you know, even with the recent, you know, the Navy sightings and the, you know, the, even NASA has got involved recently in a small kind of a way to look at some of this. The evidence still, to me, doesn't seem extraordinary. You still see these blurry pictures, even if they're taken from a Navy jet. But you can't jump from that to saying it's an extraterrestrial, even though they say, well, it's moving in ways that only you can't understand the physics the way it's moving. But you know, there are ways to get around that too with bad sensors. And you know, how far away is this thing? If it's closer, it seemed to be moving a lot faster than it really is, and that sort of thing. So I haven't seen the extraordinary evidence there yet.
Yeah, I think one of the most important components of intellectual humility is always adhering to Occam's razor. You don't come up with explanations that require leaps. You know, I tell my students, I say, you know, if you're sitting in a bar in the center of Austin sometime and you hear hoofbeats go by, assume it's horses. Don't think it's zebras, because it's most likely not zebras. It's not impossible. It could be that there was a shipment of zebras going to the zoo and they crashed and there are zebras now running through the center of Austin. But it's not very likely.
Right. Some people, you know, there are a few scientists who do that. They throw out 100 wild proposals and, you know, one of them might be right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think Loeb has done an interesting thing because, I mean, first of all, you know, his raising the idea of that asteroid that I can never pronounce properly actually being, you know, some sort of alien tech, he never said it was. He raised the idea that this would be one interesting way to explain this. And of course, people immediately jumped on it and said, oh, Harvard astronomer is saying that aliens have visited our solar system. He never said that.
And the book becomes a bestseller, too, based on the media hype.
Right, which is probably good for his bank account. So, but the thing is that, you know, it's so easy for those things to get twisted from a very reasonable question. He asked a reasonable question. And then it gets kind of blown out of proportion. And, you know, but if you start thinking about, you know, for example, your point about, well, what if aliens are post-biological? Well, then the huge time differences maybe become, you know, the time it takes to get from planet X to Earth becomes much less of an issue than it would for biological beings, because we just can't live that long, but a machine can.
Right. And you know, there are all kinds of things you would have to consider, some of which don't necessarily make the search easier, because if you're a post-biological artificial intelligence, you don't have to be on a nice warm planet around a sun-like star. You can be anywhere, which, you know, but how do you search then? So, but these are things that haven't really been thought about. And if you do find one, how do you communicate with an artificial intelligence? Well, that gets into a whole interesting area of AI and is there a general artificial intelligence, you know, and some people think that we're going to be post-biological, you know, Moravec and Ray Kurzweil and these people on Earth within a few generations, which is, you know, optimistic or pessimistic, however you think about it. But remember, the reason I'm interested in it, because you think about the time scales in the universe. The universe is 13.8 billion years old. There could be intelligence out there billions of years before us. And how would they evolve? Well, they could evolve in all kinds of different ways, but one of the most fundamental would be in their intelligence. And you can argue that artificial intelligence would be, you know, one direction that would be beneficial in a Darwinian sense and leave the others behind. So I think, you know, given what we know about the universe and those kinds of considerations, that it's not too far out to discuss, at least.
I think so. And of course, then it also places us in this sort of odd position of asking the question, well, would that post-biological intelligence even recognize us as intelligent? It's not that it would necessarily see us as not intelligent. It may just not recognize us as beings capable of intelligence. And so it winds up being really complex. And
if they could recognize us, would they even care about us?
Yeah, they might just go, oh, yeah, they're kind of interesting. Let's move on, you know?
From an anthropological point of view, right?
Right. You know, but that, I think in some ways that gets back to, you know, so one of the problems of intellectual humility is that you do see in SETI and in astrobiology a kind of almost a sense that particularly when it comes to the intelligent side of looking at things, that humans ought to be somehow inherently of interest to other beings that are intelligent because we're intelligent. And there is no good reason to think that's the case. They might just find us ridiculous. Who knows? Let me ask, we've covered a lot of different areas. And is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't covered about this topic?
Well, I just wanted to say that I've listened to some of your other podcasts, and I was particularly struck with one with the science fiction writer, Doug Richards, I think was his name, which resonated with me because he talked a lot about how difficult it was for him to get published, his science fiction to get published. And I think that's a very, very common, almost any author you talk to will tell you about. And it was the same with my dissertation, which, I shopped out to probably a dozen publishers and rejected by 11 of them, but the 12th one was Cambridge University Press. And again, talk about happenstance or luck. I mean, the commissioning editor there just happened to be interested in the subject. And so if you can find that, you've got an in. And once you're in, at least in the university press sense, you can publish even more with them. So I published 7 books with Cambridge University Press. And I've never been able, unfortunately, like Douglas Richards, to break into the commercial part because, as he said, I think, the first thing you need is an agent. You can't get to the publisher directly these days. You've got to go through an agent. And I've never had any luck with that. So,
yeah, that's actually a very, very difficult. I've gone through the same process. And It's a very interesting thing that when you land once in academic publishing, that same press is going to be interested in your work in the future. I had the same thing with State University of New York Press, and pretty much could send a proposal and they'd say, "Yep, we're interested," and I move on and write the book and it gets reviewed and all that. The process of breaking into the writing for the general public is just really, really difficult to do because there are these gatekeepers, these agents or gatekeepers. And it's very much, I think, tied to kind of the whims of what they're interested in rather than necessarily to the quality of the work that's being done. And, I think Doug, kind of realized that he turned and went the direction of basically self-publishing. And I actually just read this morning on Facebook that his latest novel is number one in forthcoming, books on Amazon. And he figured out how to kind of work with that problem and develop a different way to approach it. But it's very, very difficult. The publishing world has just filled with gatekeepers that are not necessarily driven by quality.
That's right. I've read some of Doug's science fiction novels, and they're very good. So it's too bad he couldn't break into the commercial publishers, at least not until he put it out there on his own. Speaking of science fiction, I have to say that science fiction affected very many of the people at NASA when I was there. And everybody would talk about, their favorite science fiction author. So science fiction plays a role in reality, too.
Oh, I think it plays an enormous role. I think people are, of all the different parts of literature, I think right now science fiction is probably having, in some ways, the biggest influence. Because it changes the way we see things, if you think about the way we think about our solar system, and if you go back and think about, in the 60s, the moon was really far away. We now think of it as right there. And part of that's because we went there, but part of that's because there's a lot of science fiction that has generated this sense that the moon is right next door and it's not far away. And really, our whole concept of our neighborhood, the solar system as a whole, has changed in my lifetime. And I think that's a combination of the science being done and the science fiction that's sort of spinning that process.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think I find that when I get stuck on something, to read science fiction really opens your mind again, to new ideas. In fact, I'd like to write some science fiction myself, but... It's very different from, you know, the nonfiction that I've done before, because what I'm used to doing is putting 10 footnotes at the bottom of every page. You can't do that in science fiction.
I will tell you, it's kind of liberating to move away from academic writing in that a year ago during the pandemic stuff, I sat down and decided to write a mystery novel. And but I wanted to do something different. It's an ethnographic mystery novel, so it draws on a real place in Japan where I've lived, and all of the description is very much the real place. It's just the story that's different. And it was a very interesting project to try to write fiction and not have to. It was actually somewhat liberating not to have to worry about citing things all the time. I could just write what I know. And it's worked out. It's been used in a couple of classes, and the students seem to resonate with it because it's not, you know, eggheads writing about things in complicated ways. They can actually access what's going on.
Right. But I think you still have to have a certain innate ability to write that kind of thing. I remember talking to Ben Bova, you know, Ben Bova years ago, one of the great science fiction writers. And I said to him, it must be nice to write fiction because you must be easier. You don't have to do footnotes, or, you know, you don't even have to be right about anything. And he said, oh, no. Well, he's a more of a hard science fiction guy. So he wanted to get things as realistic as possible. But he said it's not easy. And I think he's right.
I think it's. And then you kind of add another layer on it. So this is like one person who wrote, you know, there were a lot of reviews on Goodreads and that sort of thing. And one person said that the, some of the dialogue was kind of stilted, and I wouldn't really disagree with that, but it was a really difficult thing because the main character is an anthropologist, and academics tend to speak in stilted ways.
Right.
And so it was
realistic, right?
Right. And you know, so it's really difficult to kind of know how to do that. And of course it's another whole skill set. And so, it was a very interesting process to learn, and we'll see where it goes in the future.
But maybe I'll try it again.
That sounds good. I hope so. Well, Steve, I want to thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been a real pleasure. I think we had a really interesting conversation. And, you know, hopefully folks out there will learn a lot about NASA and astronomy and all sorts of interesting things.
Okay. Thanks very much. I think this is a great podcast that you're doing. So keep up the good work.